Welcome to Inclusion Bites, your sanctuary for bold conversations that spark change. I'm Joanne Lockwood, your guide on this journey of exploration into the heart of inclusion, belonging, and societal transformation. Ever wondered what it truly takes to create a world where everyone not only belongs, but thrives? You're not alone. Join me as we uncover the unseen, challenge the status quo, and share stories that resonate deep within. Ready to dive in? Whether you're sipping your morning coffee or winding down after a long day, let's connect, reflect, and inspire action together. Don't forget, you can be part of the conversation too. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seechangehappen.co.uk to share your insights or to join me on the show. So adjust your earbuds and settle in. It's time to ignite the spark of inclusion with Inclusion Bites. Today is episode 139 with the title, Turning Lead into Gold. And I have the absolute honour and privilege to welcome John Sands. John is a certified ERG trainer who empowers, no less, employee resource groups, leaders to unlock their full potential. Drawing on his vast experience as a founder, leader, and ally, he brings a fresh and impactful perspective to creating inclusive workplaces, celebrate diversity, and drive meaningful change. When I asked John to describe his superpower, he said, empathy, with the added alchemy of transforming challenges into golden opportunities for connections and growth. Hello, John. Welcome to the show.
Hello, Joe, and thank you very much for inviting me. It's a privilege to come onto your podcast.
Yes, yeah, it was great. We randomly met. I mean, in the world scale of things, it wasn't a planned meeting. I was invited to a function you were co-hosting in London, and we got chatting, and in fact, we found we had a lot in common: similar age, similar military background, similar outlook on life.
Yeah, and similar place of living as well. So we're not far. Neighbours almost, I'd say.
Almost neighbours, yeah. We've got the same weather if we look out the window.
It's been snowing this morning. Yes, yeah. And very, very cold. So I'm wrapping up and the heating is on. And it's all, snuggled down to get some warmth in my bones.
Yeah, so where are we? We're sort of midway through November, or later in November, actually, in 2024. So yeah, it's a bit of an early cold snap.
Yes, yeah, absolutely.
John, turning lead into gold.
You sent me the questions and you asked for my superpower. And as is my wont, I couldn't just say, well, it's to empower ERGs, etc., which obviously it is. But I wanted to put something in there about turning lead into gold. And now you've brought me to task with that. So I've now got to think of what I mean. So if I was to use that for... my professional role, it would be taking ideas and putting them into something that you can use and make a difference. So when I'm working with employee resource groups, you can call them ERGs, call them, you know, business resource groups, call them affinity groups, whatever you want to call them, and taking these ideas and joining the dots with these people. And it's not normally me creating that gold. The gold is created by the people that, you know, that I'm teaching. So I'm, or not teaching, or just could be facilitating, if you like, but getting these people to speak and to take an idea and make it real and for it to really make a difference in the workplace. And we were chatting, Joe, before we started recording this, about how the ERGs can make a difference within an organization is exactly that, by making these people, not making them, but helping these people to make good what they want to be doing with their community groups. So that, I would say, that would be gold, really. And like I say, the gold is created by other people, not me.
I'm sure we've got people listening who are probably not familiar with the raison d'etre of a ERG, employee resource group, staff network. Mm. How do they manifest themselves? What's their purpose in the world?
Well, it's giving people a safe place within an organization. And this could be, you know, small, could be 100 people up to thousands of people. And just to give you my my background. I worked for a large corporation, and I was part of the DE&I, another lovely, we love an acronym, don't we? Diversity, Equity and Inclusion. So I was part of that within this company, and I helped to create an ERG around disability, and also was an ally for the LGBTQIA plus ERG, the Black Alliance ERG, and also I was part of the Veterans ERG. So these are groups of people who want to come together. I call it a safe space, and they want to join forces and make the workplace better for them, to help for the issues and challenges that they have, and create a group where they can talk about their challenges. They can hopefully make a difference within the company to do that with the disability ERG that I was a co-founder of because of my experience with COVID. We looked at how my company could better support people with disability. And because a disability ERG, and I know we hesitate to use the word disability, but the challenges of people, even if they're neurodiverse, if they're physically disabled, if like me, it was a, again, hesitate to use it, but I will, a mental issue around my experience with COVID, how they can be supported with things such as, you know, help within the workplace, getting into work, time off from work when needed. So it gives you that support around you with people who are like-minded and facing the same challenges. And that works across all employee resource groups. We had Latinos Unidos, which are a Latin American support group. Like I said, the LGBTQ plus IA group, disability. There was women in technology. There was you know, so many groups that we had within there. I was lucky enough to be working at a company that supported them and allowed them to do it. So that's what an ERG is. It's a group of friends, I suppose, a group of like-minded people helping to make the workplace a better place to go to.
Yeah, because they can be extremely powerful from an organizational perspective as well. It's from my understanding, the perfect relationship is where there's symbiosis, where the members of the ERG feel that advocacy and belongingness and a safe space to better be themselves. Also, the organization benefits from having sounding boards. They can use them strategically or even tactically to look at challenges, can't they?
Yeah, well, we used to work quite heavily with the recruitment side, because we're finding more and more now when people go look at joining a company, they'll go to their webpage, they'll look at what diversity or ERGs that they have within that company, and that will help them to make the decision as to whether they should join. But not only that, also once they are there is making sure they don't leave, because I don't have the exact figures to hand, but the cost of, you know, if you bring someone on board, you train them up, you bring them into the company, you go through all that process, which takes a while, and then they just leave, the cost to the company is huge. So by giving them a workplace where, you know, they want to stay, then that really helps. We can have rose-tinted glasses and say, well, companies just want to do it because they want to support their workplace, but they also want numbers. They also want to say, well, okay, I'm doing this, but why? How is it helping? Because they're a business, and you understand that. But it's quite easy, I think, to put figures together and to support why you should have an ERG and why you should invest in that, because, you know, there's so much you gain from it. And if an employee doesn't see it, and not all do, there are some that are quite, they will say the right words, and they will say, oh yeah, we need ERGs because everyone else is doing it, and then not support it. And that's another big pitfall for this kind of thing, is they'll say, yeah, we need it, we want it on the website, we want to show we're a diverse corporation, but then they don't help to make that survive. So it withers on the vine, basically, and that's another important part of not just having ERGs, but making sure that they flourish and making sure the people within them feel they're being supported, either through money or by the board level sponsorship, etc., is just as important as saying, yeah, let's do it, and let's not support it, which happens.
Yeah, I was at an event last week, I think it was, and Bruce Daisley, the culture expert, ex-VP of Twitter Europe, I think he was, was there talking. And one of the things, one of his insightful throwaways is a real sense of valuing and judging employee experience and the belongingness of an organization is that one good sign is your best friend works at your organization.
Yeah.
And ERGs can foster that belonging and create you, if you like, friends outside of your day-to-day colleagues in an organization. And we know that that creates stickiness within the culture, doesn't it?
I think absolutely, and you're right there, and that's why I feel with ERGs, allyship is so important, because we're not only looking to support and educate the people within that group, but we're also looking to then support people outside of that group to understand. And education is very important, and that's why I said allies is, you know, make a huge difference, because you can preach to the choir. But you really want to educate people outside, because if you don't do that, then you're just, and we mentioned earlier, like I say, before we came on the podcast about an echo room, you're just talking to people who want to hear that. You need to, for a true ERG to work, is to bring on people who maybe are a bit skeptical about it. And we're finding a lot, and especially in our current political climate, we are finding a lot where that skepticism is becoming more and more prevalent, where there's a backlash towards diversity. They are saying, well, we actually want to get rid of diversity. We don't want that to happen. And there's that polarization between this is diversity and this is, you know, what we want to do. That's something we really need to stop, I feel, and is unfortunately becoming more prevalent at the moment.
In my head, I'm thinking DEI must die. So DIE, yeah. It's almost like that's the kind of the pushback at the moment, that diversity is seen as a negative now, or the initiatives, not the out end result, but the initiatives have got such a bad name.
Yeah.
Maybe poorly implemented without consideration of return on investment. People from a majority are feeling excluded from an inclusion exercise. You know, how can you create an inclusive culture by excluding people? And I think people are feeling excluded because they're not black, they're not gay, they're not a woman, and we're marginalizing people.
And that's something I have experienced myself. Being a white male, I have felt sort of not part of the gang, if you like. And that could be a perception by me, but I have felt that. Really, you know, being what I am, and I grew up at a time where it's looked back as being, you know, a dark time, where I was doing, I'm trying to put together actually a presentation around, and I call it Poor Little White Boy, because I grew up in a time where we had, even now it sort of shudder to think about it. When you think of, you know, shows like The Black and White Minstrels, buying a jar of marmalade with a cartoon character, I'm not even going to say the name, on the side of it, which you had to collect to get a badge, where people, you know, like Alan Turing, being gay was illegal. And some of the TV, and I grew up with a father who was a misogynist. Yeah, he's passed now, misogynist, a racist. And people look back on that time, and rightly so, they say, you know, that it was a bad and unenlightened time then. And I grew up within that environment. And they say that people can be formed by what they grew up with. And absolutely not for me. If anything, it made me shun those ideas. It made me into who I am. And not in a bad way. And I'm not saying that everyone who grew up in that time, you still get people say, well, you know, I grew up in those times and it was all right then, wasn't it? You know, we were okay. But that phrase of, you know, oh, the good old days, the days of, you know, where I felt comfortable, the days of where everything was okay, wasn't it? And those people are there and you see them every day. And my father was one of those, but it certainly doesn't shape me. And I'm of the strong feeling you just get bad people. You just get people that are bad, no matter what where they come from, whether they're, you know, LGBTQIA, whether they're black, whether they're white, whether they're Christian, whether they're Catholic, whatever. You just get bad people. And I hate to be painted with that brush. to people to think. And this is, I think, is one of the worst things that you can do in any. We talk about diversity, we talk about racism, and racism is painting everyone from that, in my view anyway, painting everyone within that particular group of people as one thing, as by saying, well, all Muslims are this, all Christians are this, you know, everyone within the LGBTQIA plus is this. And that's where racism comes on. You just get bad people in, no matter what you're doing in life. You just get bad people, I think.
Yeah, but inherently, bad people don't think they're bad.
No, of course not.
So we all actually believe we're good people. Every single person believes they're a good person.
Yeah.
And within your echo chamber, within your circle of friends, within your tight-knit community, within your whatever you want to call it, we all believe, because we're being reinforced, we're a product of our upbringing, product of our environment. If everyone says, yeah, I agree with you, yeah, I agree with you, confirmation bias, yeah, you're kicking all this in, affinity bias, all this stuff kicks in. Hmm. And then you believe that you're us and everybody else is them. And yeah. that's the problem sometimes, is we get so locked up into our own belief of us and everyone thinks like me. Yeah, we look at Brexit, we look at the political elections that go on, we look at what's going on in America. I can't believe that anybody would vote not like me, given the choices. But clearly, over half the population believe something different. And they're not daft. There must be a reason. But I can't fathom it, because I live in a different reality. And I don't understand why they're polarized in a different way.
Yeah, well, the amount of conversations, my mum, I love so much, and has been such a big part of my life. Not having a father figure in my life, my mum has been there for me, and my comfort blanket is my mum through my childhood and even today. But she voted Brexit, and the conversations we've had, you know, around that, and you think, and this is my opinion around the whole Brexit thing. I think it was a terrible thing that happened, but my mum did that. Someone who is such a large part of my life. So yeah,
I'm pretty sure my mum voted for Brexit as well. She's an avid Daily Mail reader, she's a GB News watcher, and very blue. And she often speaks highly of some of the people that I would question their opinions on.
I got my mum off the Daily Mail. I got a move from the Daily Mail to the Daily Express. So I'm hoping it's a little bit better than that. Yeah, yeah. And it's like you said there, Joe, around they believe that what they're saying is correct, and within within their world, and this is exacerbated, I think, because the echo chamber nowadays has got huge, isn't it? When we look at Twitter and we look at Facebook and we look at all the channels that are available to us, that echo chamber is hundreds of thousands of people, and then you're gonna think, well, okay, if they say it, then it must be true, and everyone's a hater. And that's where the polarization has come in, I think. And that certainly was there for Brexit. And also when I speak to my American friends around the elections recently, yeah, with the presidential elections, it's been such a polarization. Whereas before, and I look back to both, you know, with the political arena within the UK and also within the US, you could be, you know, you could support a party, but you could still have friends who supported the other party. But you're finding now, especially in the US and with Brexit here, it actually will tear those apart. It will break those friendship bonds or family bonds, even parts of the same family no longer speak to each other because of the way that they're voting. So it's got that polarization is incredible. It really is.
Yeah. One of the golden rules that I was always taught when we were growing up was, you don't talk about religion, politics, or money, kind of thing. And those aren't polite conversations for the dinner table or the workplace. But we have to create spaces where our beliefs aren't submerged. Because when you talk about psychological safety, you think about bringing your whole self to work, all these buzz phrases that we use today.
Yeah.
If you haven't suppressed your views and beliefs, it's not good for you as a person if you're working in an environment where you can't be who you are. So How do we square this circle of paradox where the intolerance of intolerance, you know, it's kind of, we've got to be careful here. We can't all speak our mind.
No, it's funny, isn't it? Because we were talking about at the conference we had in London, where I got to meet you, we were talking about a governance around resource groups, a governance around, because you can't say, right, anyone can create a resource group because of what that brings on. So we can say we're inclusive for everyone. It's like when they started saying, well, you know, White Lives Matter too. All that side of things, you have to be careful, really, around that side. And you know, if there's a right-wing organization and they want to create an employee resource group as well, how do you do that? It's a difficult one, because inclusivity should mean inclusivity. Freedom of speech should mean freedom of speech. But my thoughts around that are, if anything that you're doing, if anything that you want to say, right, we want to get a gang together, if that harms other people, if that is directly aimed with anger to other people, then that's where we draw the line, I feel. Yeah, I mean, that for me is really where we say, well, okay, we do have the right, but you have no right to personally enforce your views upon other people. And second of all, create direct harm within other people. And I think, me personally, that's where I would say, you know, we should draw the line.
When we look at some major political figures in our history, you know, world history.
Mm.
Nelson Mandela, freedom fighter, terrorist, world leader. Lech Walesa, freedom fighter, terrorist, world leader. And you look at Sinn Féin and some of the leaders, Gerry Adams, people like that. They went from being terrorist, freedom fighter, to political leaders in their country. And we now see Sinn Féin taking a political stance, yes, even within the North of Ireland. So it depends on who's writing the history, doesn't it?
Well, absolutely it does. Yeah, there was the issue in Bristol with the statue of the, apologies, I forget the name of the person, but I very vividly can remember them pushing the statue into the river at Bristol. You know, person who put a lot of money into schools, put a lot of money into the local community, built buildings, built hospitals, slave trader. So that, you know, where does that sit? What do you do with that? I mean, I personally think if the context is there and people understand that and people are educated around that and it's not hidden from, then that is part of history. It's the same with Nelson Mandela. I mean, again, I apologize for not being to know as much as I should do about things like that. But we put content. It happened. Yeah, these people went through a process. Some would call it terrorism. Some would call it fighting the fight. It depends where you sit on that, doesn't it? And I don't feel either you or me can sit there and comprehensively say, you know, that's wrong, because, you know, I'm not sure you can do that.
Yeah, and I mean, bringing it back to the workplace, and we've got a bit onto world politics there.
Very deep.
But you end up with this inherent conflict between the rights of each other. You know, I've seen in the civil service, they've set up a staff network that champions the supremacy of sex over gender to almost like oppose the LGBTQ+ network.
Mm.
To give people who have those beliefs a place where they feel belonging. So you have to allow people to have these thoughts and beliefs and what we call a protective belief.
Mm.
But somehow the organization has to wrestle with this to stop it becoming toxic or weaponized.
And I truly feel that there is a place for both there, but that should be encouraging conversation. That should be saying, well, okay, you know, I disagree with this. I feel it should be this. But because there's been a lot of, you know, militant actions around these things where people, it is almost like a battle. I'm right. You know, this is wrong. You know, you can't do that. You can't do this. Conversation. We should be talking about it. And even if we can't say, oh, okay, yeah, I agree now, which doesn't always happen, to respect people and to understand, if not to fully agree, but to understand and to realize that we are all human beings. We have a right to do that and to feel that way That's fine. I don't agree. That's fine. We can still live together with that. We don't have to be butting up against each other the whole time. We don't have to be, you know, agreement all the time. Maybe I'm being a little simplistic. I don't know. Maybe I am. But my feeling is we can live together even if we don't agree all the time.
Yeah, I was watching a debate on Facebook unfold the other day. It's about, I think there was some, I think it happened at a horse race and some horses died at the weekend. Mm. I'm not sure exactly the story. And someone put a post about horse racing should be banned. And someone chipped in and went, well, hang on a minute. It employs loads of people, the animals. And there was this polarized view around any animal that is enslaved by a human being is bad. Any animal you're putting to work for you, riding a horse is bad. Riding an elephant is bad. It's like, and there's someone trying to come up with another opinion. And eventually, the weight of view on this post was heavily animal rights focused. And so all the people that were trying to chip in with a balance effectively put their hands in the air and said, okay, I give up. I shouldn't have joined this conversation. Yeah. I'm out. And then people didn't want to let them out the room. They kind of say, now, hang on a minute. I haven't finished beating you up yet. I want to keep going. You don't get my point. I want to keep telling you. Okay, no, it's okay. We disagree. I'm happy to
beat you up enough until you eventually come round to what I think is the right way of doing stuff.
So people aren't happy with that retreat and acceptance. Okay, we have a fundamental difference here. Some people want to keep going, and that's they won't be happy unless they've had the satisfaction of agreement.
I think we all go for headlines because headlines make people listen or they make people watch. It's like my mum will ring me up and say, oh, you know, the country is swamped with immigration. You know, we need to sort that out. And saying, well, you're reading a headline. They sell newspapers. They're not going to say, oh, things are actually a bit okay at the moment, aren't they? We don't really need to worry. Let's say that's fine. That's not what is going to sell a newspaper. The headline is going to sell the newspaper. And I do feel that we then have adopted that. And especially when we can sit behind their keyboard and be on a Facebook chat thing or on Twitter or something, we shout stuff because it gets a reaction. It gets people to shout back. And we all want to get that reaction. We all want people to go, well, because that's what we feed on. Is people's, you know, no one wants to sit there and have a nice conversation. Yeah, that's, yeah, it's all a bit okay. And you know, actually, yeah, no, I agree with you with that. That's all brilliant. We want headlines, whether that's in a newspaper or on a message page or on you know, anywhere. We want headlines. We want reactions, and we are able to do that with the media that we work with.
Yeah, I think so. In the media the other day, it was all about working from home, working in the office. Mm. The headline was something like, the ONS has discovered, the ONS, trusted body, would chuck them in there, these trusted statistics, that people who work from home rest 20 minutes a day more than those who work in the office and do 15 minutes more exercise. And then they then quoted Jacob Rees-Mogg saying, see, these lazy people working from home are sleeping during the day.
Yeah.
Well, hang on a minute. No, at no point did it say sleeping during the day. It just they had 20 minutes a day more rest, but did 15 minutes a day more exercise. And suddenly we're extrapolating that to being anyone who's working from home is more lazy, therefore.
Yeah. Sleeping all day. They're not doing anything. Yeah.
There's no statistic on productivity in there. So they cherry picked out the resting and the exercise. So people are going on their treadmill, having a sleep, and doing less work, QED, statistic ONS. Yeah,
it's incredible. And this has been, I think, again, going back to the whole of the internet. You know, I've had an incredible life, actually. When I look at when I started my career, there was no internet. There was, you know, where I went to school, I didn't have internet. And I've gone through this gradual iteration of more and more and more and more of access, which is a wonderful thing in some ways, but a terrible thing in others. It's a beast of, you know, of two sides, really, because we've got the amazing technology that allows us to communicate and to share information. We've got the flip side of it is, like you were saying there, Joe, around, you know, us being able to, we're not just now creating a newspaper article, we're taking that newspaper article and we're putting it out to everyone that can then grab that. It's been an incredible journey to where we are, and we just need to understand that. We just need to realize that what's, you know, I try to educate my mum and say, well, you know, around the headlines, around all the information. Well, she doesn't have a computer, actually, so slightly different for her. It's using her brain. I have an amateur interest into neuroscience and using this amazing brain that we have and filtering it through. Two things I hate. I hate narrow-mindedness and I hate hypocrisy. And those two things, hand in hand, with the incredible wealth of information that we have out there, are dangerous things. Dangerous things. And we've now got people in power that, from my perspective anyway, have both of those things.
I've got a friend I follow on Facebook, and every so often he'll pop up with a very sort of predictable remark. Yeah. And today, I'm going to be an expert on nuclear missiles. And then last week, today I'm an expert on US politics. And today I'm going to be an expert on this. And it's sort of like, it's what happens every day. Whatever's in the news, people become armchair experts. It's like when the World Cup's on, everyone is home England pundit. Manager. Everyone knows which team they should have played and they're doing the critique. And we're becoming Facebook experts on everything, aren't we?
It is. That what you just said there reminds me, if you've ever watched The Fast Show, there was a character that came up. This week, I am mostly being eating tiramisu latte. That's reminded me of that and how we automatically become wheelchair experts on information. And sometimes that can be harmless and a bit of fun. On other times, not so. It's the way that that person then can be an armchair expert on hate, can spread information easily. And there are a lot of people out there, especially when we talk about social media pundits and social media, experts and these huge followings of millions of people. Sometimes they might have been a pop star at some time. They might have been the B-list celebrities that we talk about, who can get huge, huge followings and can spread that expert, perceived expertness by them. Then becomes a fodder for the huge audience of people that they have following them, and I think it can be a dangerous thing because of the spread or the audience that these people can reach out to sometimes, and people will just believe it. Some people will just go down that route and take everything as verbatim that they hear, and that's where the comes in.
Yeah, so Chris Hoy is suddenly an expert on cancer, on everyone's cancer. And
really? Okay.
And, yeah. But that's how the media are now. He's now the go-to spokesperson. So he's adding his brand and credibility to raise awareness, but he is an expert on himself. He didn't realize
it. Yes, absolutely.
An expert on cycling. Yeah. Expert on being in the Olympics, an expert on winning gold medals, but he's now participating in the experience of going through a life-changing condition, which is obviously terminal and very sad.
Very sad.
His family are coping for that. So he's telling his story in raw to the public. And we've got to be careful that he doesn't necessarily give advice or expert advice, just his personal experience.
Yeah, that you're right on that. And again, that goes back to my comment earlier about people taking it verbatim. As Chris Hoy is now a professor on cancer, it's a very sad that he went through, and him and his family having to go through that is cancer is I've had not myself experience of it, but friends that have had it and passed away. It's a terrible, terrible thing.
You mentioned at the beginning of the show, and you were talking about the bit in the green room. You also mentioned it when we met a few weeks ago. Around your expertise in COVID.
Yes. I would not say expertise in any way whatsoever. Experience,
yeah.
Of COVID. If you call it, this time 4 years ago, I was in a coma after catching COVID back November time, beginning of November. So, I got the usual cough and then got hold of the 111 and they then sent an ambulance, and then I ended up in a hospital with COVID. And I did a diary the whole time on what I was. I'm so glad I did, because I can go back and go through my experience with that. And right from, you know, turning up and thinking, oh, they'll pump me full of antibiotics or some magic drug that will make it go away. And there was no vaccine at the time. So I went straight in and gradually, well, it was up and down. It was really, again, from my diary, it was a roller coaster, because COVID, the little bastard, actually goes to your brain stem and makes you feel that you're okay. So it can do its work. So I was going up and down, and I was on a thing called a CPAP, where they force air into your lungs. It's like, the way they describe, the way I would describe it, it's like when you're going along in a car and you put your head out the window. Absolutely. And that forcing of air into your lungs and the gradual decline, they even sent my wife in at one point. And that doesn't happen unless it's really, really bad. So I got to spend some time with her, and which was two things. It was beautiful to see her, because I was in an airlock. So I was in a room where you had to go through into an airlock, you know, shut the door, open the other door, and come in and see me. Where people, you know, to come in to see me, it was had to put in all their the gloves and the apron and the mask and all that, and then come in, see me, go out, take it all off again. And if I needed to see them again, they'd have to come in again. Incredibly isolating and very frightening. I was the most frightened I've ever been in my life. And I wrote in my diary, I don't think I'm going to finish this diary, because my breathing was getting so bad. And this is another bag of worms. When I hear about people who are anti-vaccine, I would like to bottle how I felt when about 75% of my lung capacity was gone. And I wouldn't want to give them the virus. I would never want to do that to anyone. But I'd want them to just experience how I felt just for 30 seconds, just to get the figure where you feel like you're drowning, where you feel like you think that's it. And again, in my diary, I said, yeah, this is it. I'm going to die. And when it got at its worst, I wanted to die. I wanted it all to go away, and I couldn't speak, so I just went to the nurse. I then got put into a coma and put on a ventilator, and then that's when the fun stuff happened. Then, because when I'm my God, coma dreams, Joe. I'm not recommending it for anyone, but I was on an NHS cruise ship going to Abu Dhabi. That's what my dream was, and I was going along quite happily on the cruise ship. I had people in beds next to me. We got to Abu Dhabi. I got off the boat and went to a party. I was still in my bed. I was still dreaming in my bed, and I was still strapped in, and I had all everything on me. But I was in my bed being wheeled around Abu Dhabi, and then taken back onto the boat, and then I woke up. Now, I was in a coma for 11 days, and I woke up, and the first doctor that came to me, I said, do you really send people on cruise ships in the NHS? Because I still believed in my befuddled state that it had happened. And she said, I can assure you, Mr. Sands, you haven't left Portsmouth. So I was on this, I'm sure I was on this cruise ship. I was brought round It was an amazing, amazing thing to go through. I went to, while on the cruise ship, I went to a bird show. I went and saw dolphins while I was on there. There was a restaurant there. It was just amazing. And that was 11 days of being asleep in a coma. And luckily, because at that time, if you were put on a ventilator, you only had a 10% chance of survival. Which I didn't realize till much, much later that was the case. And I come round and I got out, and I'm thankful for the fact that that I did survive, and I did come out of that. But I've never ever lost that feeling. The feeling I had when I thought I was lying on the bed and I was thinking, what's it going to be like to die? What's it going to be like to close my eyes? And I truly thought, I'm going to close my eyes now, and I'm going to be dead. What's that going to be like? And that's why I was part of a founder of the disability RG, because of that, the mental scars. And now my lungs are fine. I have no physical scars from that, and none whatsoever. But the mental side of that and that feeling, because you never lose that. You never, I'm not sure you should either, really, because the experience makes you what you are. But it is something that stays with you forever. You know, reliving that sometimes. And I don't mind reliving it now. Like we're talking now, I'm quite happy to do that. And I do it a lot. I like to talk, as you probably can tell. But there is a scar there that I've got. So COVID for me was incredible. I've taken all the vaccines I can find. You know, bring me a vaccine, I'll have it. Yeah, absolutely.
I even went
on a vaccine trial and did that as well because I believe, you know, this is going to sound like a cliche. We've all been hitting the saucepans outside our house during COVID. But what they did for me, the wonderful, amazing nurses that came in and gave me, from being in that isolation chamber that I was in, that came in with smiles. And I said to one of the nurses, you know, what's it like out there? And he said, it's terrible. He goes, you know, people are passing. And she stroked my arm and said, but not you. You're not going to go. And I thought, wow, yeah, it was. My thanks go out certainly to all those people, my consultant, my nurses, whoever that did that was amazing.
Guess it's because you were going to Abu Dhabi, not on the Titanic to New York. If otherwise,
yes, yes, no, the ship didn't sink. It actually docked in Southampton and let me off in an ambulance and brought me back to Portsmouth, the QA.
Did you feel? I mean, I'm guessing. Please enlighten me. Did you feel time passing, or was it random images, or did you feel like you were in an Agatha Christie movie or something?
No, time passed. So, you know, I went to the bird show. I got wheeled out to the bird show. I went to I think it was dolphins, some weird animal swimming in a tank. Yeah, so time did pass. It wasn't purely linear, I don't think, because there were times, actually, I had part of that was not Abu Dhabi. It was going out and meeting up with my family in a cinema somewhere. So that happened as well. So, but in my mind, I've kind of logically placed it together. Maybe it was, maybe during the dream, it was all over the place. I don't know. But the brain, as I said, is a marvelous organ. And I think it probably helped to put it into some, to make sense of it, to shuffle the cards that were dealt me during the coma and put it into a logical place. I'm sure that may have happened, but my recollection now, I did a video of it. I put it on YouTube. So I did some videos while I was actually in hospital with the mask on and with that, and I put that together into a video that I put onto YouTube. So I think I almost certainly would, to make, because your brain does that, to make sense of that. If it doesn't quite fit, it'll say, oh, okay, well, this could be there, that should be there, this should be there, and does that. So it's not like I woke up from my coma at the beginning and then went into it at the end. It give it some kind of linear side to it.
Does it feel at the time, or your memory of that feel, did it help your state of mind? I mean, were you scared in this coma dream? Were you having a time of your life? Were you worried about things in this dream?
I had some sad moments in there. I mean, one of the people that I was with on board the ship died while I was there. I had some frustrating times when I wanted to go and see the bird show, but they wouldn't let me in. I had some times where I was on board ship, and I asked one of the nurses to go and take some pictures of Abu Dhabi, because I'd never been to Abu Dhabi before. And she got chucked off the ship because she shouldn't have been taking pictures. So I was worried that, oh my God, how's she going to get home? Well, I'm going to have to pay for that. I want her to get home. So I had all of those feelings as well while I was in there. So it was a complete mixture of emotions. The cruise ship side is actually explained, because I spoke to one of the nurses afterwards. She said, well, the reason this happens a lot is because you're on a bed that is moving, because they want to stop you getting pressure sores. So the bed is moving. Yeah. So being on a cruise ship or being on a boat is quite normal. I was in the Navy as well. So there's probably a part of that that came in. I thought there were children underneath my bed at one point. I was lying in my bed and there were children bashing underneath my bed. And that's because they put these blow up compression tubes on your legs to stop you from getting DVT. And that was the bashing. So, yeah. So there was a whole mix of emotions in there. Not one the whole time. I don't remember being frightened at any point. I remember being worried that I wasn't going to get back on the ship on time because they'd take me away and done whatever. But no, I was never frightened. The frightening time was when I was awake. That was frightening.
As you're talking there, I'm thinking back to the Matrix film, the first one.
Oh, yes.
And the artificial world that's created for people, the AI realized that it couldn't be perfect. It had to have challenge and risk and drama, because a utopian kind of world isn't real. The human brain needs something more. So maybe you actually created drama out of your thought. So your mind has something to tackle and challenge it.
I think you're right, because that's our life. Again, our brain is a very, we use the word plasticity. It adapts and molds itself to your experience and your life. And we create these neural pathways with, synaptic pathways, which are based upon our experiences in life. And we build those, some good, some bad. And those neural pathways are what create your dreams. Because, the amount of dreams I have when I'm worried I'm not going to get to the airport, or I'm worried that I'm going to miss something, or I can't get my suitcase. And that's me. Oh my God, when I go to the airport, I have to be there 3 hours before, no matter where I'm going, because I worry about not being there on time. I never understand people who say, I get there 10 minutes before. I never worry about that. That would drive me mad. I just couldn't do it. So your brain doesn't change when you go to sleep. Some of the dreams I have as well, that we won't talk about now, are not part of my everyday life. But the bones and the pathways are there, no matter if you're dreaming or if you're conscious.
You said that you talked to the nurses when you woke up again, and they kind of explained away the boat and the compression, all this kind of stuff. Have you spoken to any other coma survivors about their experience, or is this you're your own expert, if you like, no other?
No, I haven't. And not long after I came out, I thought, would that be a good idea? I got a bit frightened about it, I think. When I thought, maybe a support, because there isn't anything out there. There isn't anything, of people, well, not that I know of anyway. So I did think about it, but then I backed up, because I wasn't sure how I could handle that with other people. I'm talking about it quite happily now, and I'll talk about it with my wife and with my close friends, and put a YouTube video out there. But I'm not sure how, well, at that time, certainly I wasn't sure how I would deal with that. And I did get a bit frightened, so I backed off from it. I've gone through counseling, and I've spoken to, a therapist around there, but putting a support group together, I've not done that. Again, as I said, I think I got a bit of cold feet on that.
I've got two experiences in my life that gives me some relatability to what you went through. I never went through a coma, I don't believe. So when I was about 12, 13, I went on a school excursion to France, to Entretat, to see the tapestry, the Bayeux tapestry.
Nice.
And on the way back, I'd obviously developed some sort of flu, cold, whatever it was. And on the boat, I had this extreme high temperature. Mm. I had to stand on the deck of the boat to try and cool myself down. I was in the bar area or wherever it was, sitting area, and my temperature rose and rose and rose. And eventually, obviously, the teachers and people got worried about me, and they ended up calling me an ambulance onto the boat. So I got taken off of the...
Really?
...the ferry in an ambulance with the blues and twos on, took me straight to Southampton General and put me in an isolation ward. They thought I had a meningitis at the time, but it turned out to be some sort of bacterial viral infection. When I had this extreme high temperature, my muscles all locked up. I couldn't move. I was literally rigid. I think my temperature was 106 or something like that, on that real cusp of being.
Yeah.
When I went up to get to the loo at one point, I went to the door, and there's this big red sign saying, isolation ward, do not enter. It's like, oh, this is quite serious, isn't it? I look back, and my parents were obviously worried at the time. So I had that sort of... And I remember the coach driver, because I sat on the coach waiting for the ambulance. He said, don't worry, you're not going to die. I was 13 years old. I was invincible. I didn't think I was going to die anyway. And suddenly someone said, you're not going to die. Whoa, okay. Suddenly there comes home. And the next time it happened was when I was 2013, so 10 years ago, give or take, I got double pneumonia. And it was on Christmas Eve. I was feeling rough for a few days. Christmas Eve, I sat in the chair, all the family around. My throat was raw. I couldn't swallow, couldn't drink anything, couldn't breathe. I went to bed that night, Christmas Eve. And every time I laid back, I felt like I was drowning.
Yeah.
My throat was so sore, I couldn't cough. Of course, I needed to cough, but I couldn't cough. I needed to cough, but I couldn't cough. And eventually we called a paramedic at about 4 o'clock in the morning, Christmas Day. He went, you need to go to A&E. Quick, get there now. So I got, my wife dropped me down there, and I saw this consultant, and he thought I was having an asthma attack. So he gave me this nebulizer to puff on. And of course, that triggered me even worse. And his face went white as a sheet. He thought he killed me. Basically, really? I was choking and choking with his nebulizer. He thought it'd be cool, magic. That'll fix you. And suddenly, I'm in a ward. Christmas Day, tubes up the nose, breathing oxygen, and I was feeling I couldn't breathe. I really felt I couldn't breathe. So
you know that feeling, about
that feeling of drowning.
Yeah. That not being able to get enough air into your lungs is because that's your life. For that, and it's I even had it during my coma dream. I was trying to drink a smoothie through my breathing tube for whatever reason, because they tried to extubate me, but it didn't work, so they had to put the tube back down again. And I'm probably thinking that was why I had that feeling of drinking a smoothie through my air tube, which is weird. So that feeling there, you know, that feeling you had when you're lying in a hospital bed on the, of all times, Christmas Day is must have been horrible for you.
Yeah, well, the thing is, when you're that ill, time passes in a different way, doesn't it?
Yes, absolutely.
Everybody else is worried about you. Your sole concern is staying alive. And one thing I've observed throughout various, I've had other instances, not quite as bad over the years, is I've come to realize that when you're really ill or you're not well, you don't get bored. You can stare at the ceiling 4 hours a day and you're completely cool with it. And you can tell when you're getting better because suddenly you get fidgety, bored, and you want to start doing stuff. So I can always tell when I'm on the recovery, when my mind goes, right, okay, I want to read a book. I want to watch telly.
Yeah.
But before that, flat on my back, okay, I'm out of it. And I talked to friends who have been through experiences and I said, did you find this point where you started getting bored? They went, yeah, funny that. All of a sudden, I was really fidgety and bored. I said, that's the brain's way of saying you're on your way back.
When they put me onto a general ward after I was getting better. And that was when I started, because I couldn't really get up and about. I had a catheter. I had oxygen. I had tubes everywhere. And I just wanted to get out and I wanted to get up and about and go home. Because when, like you said, when you're really ill, when I was really ill, but my biggest worry, I didn't want to die. Of course I didn't. But my biggest worry was everyone else. And my worry was my wife and my children and my brother and my mum. They were who I was worried about, because I can't do anything about where I am now. You put yourself into the hands of other people. I can't do any more than just lie here, have them do whatever, and I can't do anything. But the people that are outside of that, because they couldn't come up and see me. Now, that was one of the things with COVID. They couldn't come up to the ward, but it was everyone else around. My wife had lost her partner to suicide many, many years ago. And my thought was, my God, you know, she might lose me now after having that. And but going back to what you're saying, I wanted to do stuff. I wanted to get out. I wanted to read. I'll have my iPad out. I wanted to, just involve the mind, whereas before my mind was involved with everything else that was around it. You're just a passenger.
Yeah. To quote the Bee Gees, staying alive, staying alive.
Gotta love the Bee Gees.
John, I really love this conversation. I mean, we spoke briefly as we said earlier, a couple of weeks ago, and there's a whole load of other stuff that we've got in common. Anyway, we dived into your Navy career and everything else, and our joint shared passion for the city of Portsmouth, I guess, as well.
Absolutely. Well, there's a time for another podcast sometime, AJ. We could many, many things we could talk about.
Yeah, I'd love to. So, John, you mentioned the YouTube video. How do people get hold of you? You're obviously on LinkedIn. Tell people about YouTube video and
can find out more about it. Just search for John Sands on YouTube and you'll also find a very famous Australian greeting card manufacturer as well called John Sands. So, that's not me. If it was, then I'd have a bit more money than now. But LinkedIn, really, I see my life at the moment. I love doing the work I do with ERGs. I work with the ERG Leadership Alliance and train, part of what what they do, and look out for that. Like I say, go to LinkedIn. If you want to message me, they'll connect, then please do. I'd be more than happy. I'm a very social person. I'm not as business focused as I was before. I'm going through life doing what I want to do now, helping when I can help, using that empathy, which I do see is one of my superpowers. Don't ask me to turn lead into gold. I'm not quite there yet. I'll keep trying, but do just reach out and chat, and I'm sure they could contact yourself, Joe. You've got all my details there as well, and I'm more than happy. Is it okay to give out my email address? If is that all right? Yeah. So johnsands@hotmail.com. Do reach out to me. I'd be great to do that. Go to LinkedIn, connect with me on LinkedIn. I'll be more than happy to chat about that and anything ERG related.
Yeah. And if you've got your own COVID story, then drop your LinkedIn message and see how it goes. Yeah.
Well, yeah, absolutely. It'd be great to hear from other people. I said I got cold feet before, but I'm a big lover of organic work as well. Well, things just happen, and you, like meeting with you, Joe. You know, last when we had the ELA meeting in London. You know, these things happen for a reason. I think I don't believe truly in fate, but they do happen, and when they do, you grab that opportunity and start something. Hopefully, which will be good,
John. It's been an amazing conversation. I really enjoyed the chat today. Thank you.
As we bring this conversation to a close, I want to express my deepest gratitude to you, our listener, for lending your ear and heart to the cause of inclusion. If today's discussion struck a chord, consider subscribing to Inclusion Bites and become part of our ever-growing community, driving real change. Share this journey with friends, family, and colleagues. Let's amplify the voices that matter. Got thoughts, stories, or a vision to share? I'm all ears. Reach out to joe.lockwood@seachangehappen.co.uk and let's make your voice heard. Until next time, this is Joanne Lockwood, signing off with a promise to return with more enriching narratives that challenge, inspire, and unite us all. Here's to fostering a more inclusive world, one episode at a time. Catch you on the next bite.